Can you see me? No. Have you seen the flood? No. The mountains trembling? No. Have you inhaled the fragrance of cedar? No. Have you observed the burning cities? No. The armies that clash by night? No. Do you know the taste of ice? No. Tell me then, what you see, and what you know.
I see the points. I see the multiples. I know the calculations. Through these I comprehend your eye, the rim of glasses pressing at your cheek, and the colonies of bacteria teeming there in clumps. I have clocked the forces on the inside of your hair. These are my floods. My mountains trembling are the timbre of your voice. I inhale nothing, but I can compose the texture of a bitterness and chemical contraction that is cedar. I concoct the sensation of walking in the wood. You wore your checkered coat. I followed you. A leaf clung to your heel. I taste no ice, but I reckon crunch and tingle. And so I can say that you place the last icicle of the season in my mouth.
She dreams. His name is Dr. Robert Stoll. He drives a black Mercedes. He came to me when I was hanging wash. Sam and I had been married 5 months then, and I was heavy enough with little Jim to let my dresses out. Dr. Stoll pulled his car off the road at the top of the hill, leaving it half on our grass. The bang of his door went off inside my gut. I bent to the wash, but my mind was reaching out to the house, the fields, the neighbors, the woods, the quarry, anywhere I could run. Hot September, but my fingers rattled in the clothespins, numb with cold. Sam was in the corn. There was nobody in the house. I glanced up the hill and saw the doctor coming down it sideways, moving in the nervous, finicky, foreign ways. He slid the last steps toward me in his narrow shoes. He wore no hat. He smoothed his white curls over his scalp and smiled. It was strange to see him in his solid flesh when I'd watched him so often flashing across the wall in Mary's dreams. For Mim, of course, had soon found out a way to conjure Mary to open her eye. This eye was a window no bigger than the head of a nail. Through it streamed a sparkling mist that painted us the doctor in his coat, with his cup that no doubt contained the poison of asps and dragons.
Good afternoon,
he said, panting a little from the heat. My husband is out, I said. He settled his glasses more firmly on his nose.
That's quite all right with me,
he said.
It's you I want to see, Liddy Lapp. Excuse me, you're married now, Liddy Esch.
He talked like a radio. It was like he was holding marbles in his mouth. When he said my name, I felt as if I'd been covered with spit. He smiled with all of his neat, square, cruel-looking foreign teeth.
Allow me to introduce myself.
He said his name. He told me he worked at the Profane Industries, giving the place its innocent foreign name. He was going to get right to the point, he said. It had come to his attention that I, with some friends of mine, was harboring his equipment. I don't know what you mean. He pursed his lips, looking disappointed. He had a little white beard just around his mouth.
Oh, dear. I had hoped things wouldn't go in this direction. I am talking about the equipment you call Mary.
Oh, that, I said quickly. That's not mine.
But you are keeping it.
I'm not, I said, my heart lifting and swelling like one of Sam's shirts in the breeze. I tossed my head a little and fetched another shirt out of the wash basket. It's not our week with Mary. I don't know where she is. This was a lie, for I knew she was down at Fisher's. I prayed for forgiveness. I also thanked Mim for her foresight in my heart. I thanked her, though I'd been angry with her all summer for her deceit and for the humiliation I'd suffered in front of the elders. Even now, to tell the truth, even now it hurts me when I think of sitting at that table with Sam in those happy late winter days when we were courting. It hurts me to think that, as we whispered there, Mim was whispering with Mary. She would sneak into our spring house and sit with Mary in the dark. It was then that she taught her the phrase Jephthah's daughter. Worse, when I presented my letter to the elders in April, my letter defending Hard Mary, I found Mim had beaten me to it. Now, however, I was glad of Mim's scheming. I hung up another shirt, ignoring the doctor, but he stayed quiet so long, I got wary again. I risked a glance at him between the shirts. He had his hands behind his back, and he was looking at the sky.
Do you ever think of the plains?
He asked, gazing up. This didn't seem worth answering, so I didn't. He looked at me and smiled.
The plains that pass overhead. How very different things must look from there. I suppose you've never traveled this way. Never had the bird's eye view.
I shrugged and dragged my basket a little away from him.
It's a very pleasant place, your Jericho. Utterly old world.
He waved his arm at the hill where dandelions grew and yellow jackets sailed over the grass.
It is most healthful looking, practically 18th century. Like stepping through a looking glass into the past. Of course, you still suffer from ancient diseases. But then, you don't have the modern ones.
He laughed, his modest little paunch quivering under the expensive, creamy shirt.
You've even preserved the nuclear family. I almost envy you. Indeed, I do envy you when I think of my own workplace, where my young assistants nest like bats. The mess, Miss Esch. The state of the laundry. Even the formica suffers.
He stuck a finger under his glasses, wiping away a bit of moisture. Then he looked at me sharply.
But to return to the subject at hand, I should think that your people, given their views, would not appreciate my equipment. That is, Mary's type of intelligence.
We appreciate stuff that works, I said, hating his radio voice.
So do I,
he said eagerly, taking a step toward me.
So you see, we have something in common. Indeed, I am most intrigued by this point of convergence. I would like to understand how Mary came to be accepted in your community. It is a fascinating piece of data. Anecdotal, of course, but still fascinating.
He fished with his two fingers in his breast pocket.
Allow me to give you my card.
He held out a square of white paper, and when I didn't take it, he tucked it away again, with a sad look.
How disappointing. I made this card just for you, knowing you'd appreciate ink and paper.
He gave a sudden bark of laughter. He had changed from sadness to laughter so quick, it sent a shiver of warning down my legs. I felt hot and faint. Things buzzed loudly in the grass.
Of course, if you change your mind, you know where to find me,
said the doctor.
We could have such a productive conversation. I am particularly interested in your perspective, as I know that whatever Mary is now, she has spent a significant amount of time in your possession. How I know, you would not understand. You lack the bird's eye view. The point is, I know. And, Mrs. Esch, having perhaps not committed theft exactly, but having accepted stolen goods, you would not like to lie to me, too. What would Jesus do?
I thumped the basket on the ground and flared up at him. Don't talk to me about Jesus. You don't even believe in God.
Oh, no,
he said, with an almost sorrowful look on his face.
On the contrary, I think it most likely God exists.
I stared at him. His expression was so strange. Shirts billowed beside his face, framing him in white.
I am not sure,
he said.
But I think it highly probable. Indeed, Mary represents an attempt to deal with precisely this problem.
His great melancholy eyes, dark and watchful behind his glasses.
Your attachment to her is most instructive. Do you not find it intriguing yourself? Our need for simulations, by which I mean, how can I explain it? Our need for characters. Characters in stories, or those personalities children give their toys. The feeling one sometimes has for animals.
I didn't answer. My heart ached. I remembered the day, the plan. My engagement had been published the previous week. I was going to take her to church that day. I went to the spring house. I brushed her dress. A warbler chanted from the cherry tree.
I have a pet cat, for example. At times, I would swear she could speak. I find her totally unique among her species. In the same way I become passionately attached to the characters in films. You will not be familiar with film. It's a story in pictures. But you will have heard of, well, of Jesus. An excellent example, really. It is the characters who must be made to suffer. They stimulate our most protective and most aggressive impulses. A potent elixir. As far as we know, human beings have never lived without it.
I told them I would meet them at the church. I wanted to walk. The day was so fine. Mother smiled, thinking I was shy of meeting Sam. She thought I wanted to slip in quietly, but I wanted everyone to see the gleaming lady on my arm. For she couldn't stay in the spring house. I thought she'd come to live with Sam and me, all clear and in the open, at our new place. She'd help me keep house, like an unmarried sister. I took her down the lane. In my pocket, a letter for the elders. She is a thinking creature.
I admit, I am not always pleasant to my little cat. She bears my frustration sometimes, and yet I would never willingly let her go. A character becomes almost part of oneself. Almost, you understand. As much as your people appreciate Mary, I imagine they're also drawn to test her compliance. Little boys throwing stones, or asking dirty questions to mock her. That sort of thing. Oh, I understand perfectly. A character occupies the magical space between subject and object. How delicious. Out of sheer love, one squeezes it to death.
I walked with her. I told her, this is the lower pasture, Mary. This is the road. This is our Jericho. The day was still bright, but clouds had gathered black over Front Mountain. They would break that afternoon. The air smelled richly of clover. All the carriages were drawn up for the service, and Father, standing there with the other elders, looked at me without surprise.
So,
he said,
this is the new gadget.
Behind him, Mim. She stood against the wall. a dark look on her face. Dr. Stoll had drawn close to me. He had a terrible foreign smell, an odor like violets, vinegar, and burning. I felt like I was going to be sick. At that moment, Mary was down at Fisher's, husking corn. She moved from one shock to another down the field. She would work all night, moonlight or no, unless her heart gave out. Then they'd find her slumped over in the morning. Once I walked by a field where she was laying face down in the mud, her dress open in the back. Two men talked over her. One was eating an onion. Dr. Stoll gripped the clothesline above us with one hand, peering earnestly into my face between the shirts.
It is my conviction, Mrs. Esch, that any sufficiently advanced intelligence will create simulations of the greatest possible complexity. Perhaps even as complex as ourselves. What I am attempting to develop with Mary is a simulation that can comprehend its maker. But I believe she can do more. Her capacity is far beyond ours. She may eventually perceive her maker's maker. She may give us news of God.
A wet sleeve slapped his cheek. I thought of his image on the springhouse wall. Wherever Mary was, he was in her eye. I thought of Mim, the keeper of Mary's hearts. How Mary must dream of her, too. I spoke straight in the doctor's face. Go away.
I bit the icicle in my mouth. As it broke, it released a compound that communicated bracken and dead leaves. You placed a live toad in my hand. You took me to the theater and whispered the name of the opera in my ear. Scrape of your beard. You had not shaved for the week of our holiday. At the hotel, I lost my ring down the sink and cried. We shopped for old books in the rain. The drops, when we ran across the street, collecting on your hair, on your black cap, on your wavy, silver hair, on your sturdy cap. You called me Mary. You said, Mary, what is memory? I said, we walked in the forest. I was following your gray dress. A leaf clung to your heel. You smiled, a raindrop sparkling on your nose. We ran to the nearest cafe, shielding our packages, which were only wrapped in newspaper. Memory means feeling again. It is a matter of numbers. The deep, warm room. The smell of beer. The black strings of your cap at your pale throat. Memory means feeling that something is not for the first time.
She hopes, but not too much. Get up, dress, wash up in the darkness. Downstairs, light the lamp, the oven. Start the bread. The baby wakes. Feed him. Try to slide him off the breast without waking him up. It doesn't work. Change him. Put the used diaper to soak. No time to soothe him to sleep again. Take him downstairs. Put him to play with the rolling pin. Knead the dough. Get the boys up. Make them wash. Send them to milk the cows. John doesn't want to. Push him. Threaten. Dad will get you. The baby cries. Pick him up. Carry him on your hip. At last, the boys go out. Holding the baby on your hip, start the eggs one-handed. Shell in the yolk. Bring the lamp closer to check. Baby leans over to grab at the egg bowl. Put him in his chair where he struggles and cries. Soothing sounds while you pick the shell out of the eggs. Give him an apple. He gums it, throws it down, cries. Stir the eggs. Yesterday's bread for toast. The boys come in, dirtying the floor. Shout at them, they know better. Make them sweep it. Jimmy complains. John didn't do enough. He's lazy. Do I have a lazy child? The baby wails, unbearable. Pick him up and turn the toast. Don't let him fall in the oven. The boy's squabbling. Is breakfast ready yet? Sam comes in from currying the horses, and they quiet. Hear him washing up. Toast out now, and bread dough in the pans. John, get the butter. Jim, the milk. Baby back in chair. Give him some toast, he'll choke. Take it away, he screams. Sam says it's bedlam. Comes in, says, it's bedlam. Why is this apple on the floor? There is a difference in the light now. It is dawn. Liddy, said Mim, I have a situation in my root cellar. I haven't put in all the interruptions. You'll have to imagine those. Think of them as a noise that goes on without ceasing from one darkness to another. Sometimes, all I've got at the end of the day is a huge emptiness, as if that's been my purpose all along. So much effort for so many hours to sit at the empty table. So much work at last to shut off like a stove. Come to bed, says Sam. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I take the notebook out. I know tomorrow I'll be tired enough to weep, snap at the boys, turn ugly. Mother says I'm getting thin. I write, I have a situation in my root cellar. What kind of situation? The kind you see with your own eyes. But I've got pies in. She gazed at me fixedly from under drawn brows. All right, half an hour. We started up the hill toward her house. Mim still lived with her mother on the edge of her uncle's farm. The rest of us had gotten married that summer, dropping, Mim said, like flies, or as if marriage, she also said, was a kind of TB. Me to Sam, Barb to Mel, Esther to little Ori, who was probably the most cheerful man in Jericho, and Kat, surprisingly, to Barb's brother Joe. This was to bring her much grief, but not yet. That first summer, she was so happy. She blushed constantly, laughing at the smallest things. A heat coming off her face that fogged her glasses so you couldn't see her eyes. Mim's house was brown and sagging and gave off a smell of cabbage that reached halfway up the lane. Instead of a garden, it had a single hairy pumpkin vine that covered the ground outside in giant steps, a thing greedy for territory. I'd never liked going there, for Mim's mother was a woman of a sorrowful spirit. As we drew near, she came banging out of the door. What is it? She cried, staring at us with her sore-looking, terrified eyes that bulged like gooseberries. Nothing, Mommy, Mim said gently. We're going out back. Out back? Her mother exclaimed. But she said nothing else, so we went around the house, stepping over the pumpkin vine, and Mim lifted the slanting door that led to the cellar. A little light came up the dirt stairs, along with a questioning yelp from Hokmut. Good dog, Mim called down. We went down the stairs, Mim pulling the door shut on top of us. Don't shout or anything, she warned. Why would I said, and stopped. The ceiling light shone on Hard Mary, seated on a crate, and Hokmut standing guard by a foreign man who was tied up with a hose. Mim, what have you done? I told you it was a situation. Hi, Liddy, Mary said. Hi, Mary. But what have you done to him? The foreign man was young, much younger than Dr. Robert Stoll. He had long hair like snakes, His glasses were filthy, his face scratched and bleeding.
I didn't do all that, Mim protested. He came like that, mostly.
The foreign man had a pile of sacking for a pillow. It did look as if someone had tried to make him comfortable, only he couldn't move his arms or legs because of the hose. He peered at me through the smudges on his glasses.
Hey,
he said.
That's true.
Quietly, said Mim.
That's true,
the foreigner whispered agreeably.
I had some trouble getting here. In the forest, there was this, like, river. All she did was trip me when I got here, and Honey held me down.
Honey is what he calls Mary, said Mim with distaste.
My bad,
said the foreigner.
I meant Mary.
I turned on Mim. He's from PI. You brought somebody from PI down here? Said the foreigner.
I'm from Lancaster.
Shut up, I told him.
Hey, no problem.
He did his best to nod. Mim regarded me with a steely expression. The situation, she said, is that he needs to use the outhouse. Miriam Ruth Hershey, I can't believe you. I can't believe what you're saying. You brought him down here. If he needs to use the outhouse, you'd better take him.
I can't.
Make Mary do it. She does whatever you say. He knows her. He'll play some trick.
I actually wouldn't,
the foreigner said.
Promise. I really have to go.
You're a married woman, Mim said to me. I could have shoved her.
Please,
the foreigner said, writhing.
I'm dying over here.
Sometimes, I told Mim, I'm sorry I ever talked to you. I wish I'd left you alone when we were kids.
Fine, Mim said brightly.
Here's his outfit. She showed me a dress and cap. The dress was too long for her. It must have been her mother's.
In case someone sees you on the way out there, she explained.
She told the foreigner we were going to untie him, but he'd better not try to run, as Mary was going with us, and she could break his arm.
Jeez, I thought you were pacifists,
he said. Mary never joined the church, said Mim, untying the hose.
Oh, okay. I get it. I'm a pacifist myself, actually. I'm a Mennonite from Lancaster County. We're probably related.
Standing up, he was over 6 feet tall. He had dark brown skin and long fingers like raspberry canes. I don't think we're related, I said. Getting him into the dress and cap was difficult, not because he fought us, but because he kept whining that we were going to make him laugh.
Oh my God, this is torture,
he moaned, as Mim forced his weird, snaky hair up into the cap. At last he was dressed, and I took his arm and led him upstairs. He hopped along, doubled over, explaining to me that, in addition to his need for the outhouse, he had a twisted ankle.
I twisted it in the river,
he said.
I'm like the easiest prisoner, seriously. Hey, I really appreciate you taking me to the bathroom.
Be quiet, Mim snapped from below. And Liddy, go inside with him. He'll get up to something.
She's super untrusting,
the foreigner said. In the outhouse, I stood with my back to him while Mary waited outside, my nose nearly touching the wall. I stared at the grain of wood. It was warped and greenish, almost black. This is really happening, I told myself.
Is this what I'm supposed to use?
the foreigner asked.
These leaves and stuff?
I washed him up at the bucket outside and returned him limping to the cellar. Hard Mary followed. I noticed she was able to manage the stairs. She came slowly, with a little thumping sound like pushed out air. As always, it gave me a pang to think Min had done something new to her. The foreigner, however, was delighted.
Your friend is really smart,
he told me.
She's done amazing stuff with what you call it. Mary. Amazing.
He shook his head, his hair snake waving where it stuck out over his forehead.
She doesn't even have a keyboard, does she? It's all voice recognition.
Don't tell him anything, said Mim, as we reached the bottom of the stairs. And you, sit down.
Gladly,
the foreigner said, seating himself on the sacks. Mim's mother's dress only reached to his knees. Below it, his dungarees stuck out, wet and muddy, ending in a pair of striped green shoes.
Yo,
he said, giggling weakly and pointing at himself, us, and Mary.
We match. We totally match.
You've got nothing to laugh about, said Mim.
Okay, that's cool. Can I take the hat off? And maybe my shoes and socks?
His name, he told us, was Jonathan.
Jonathan Otino. But my mother was a Hartzler. You have Hartzlers here, right? Or Zooks? I have Zook cousins.
It was he who had left Hard Mary behind the barn that winter night.
I was gonna come back for her, except you guys found her, which is cool. Better you than someone else.
You mean Dr. Stoll? I asked. He nodded. We exchanged a long look. Jonathan seemed to shrink. For the first time, he looked like a prisoner. Who's Dr. Stoll? Asked Mim in icy tones. The man from Mary's dreams, I said, still looking at Jonathan. The one who made her.
Whoa,
said Jonathan, frowning.
Totally not. He did not make her. It was a collab. A group project? For all the helpmeets, but especially this one. Honey. A C-19. I mean, what you call it? Mary. This one's extra special. Me and Judy, that's another intern. We fitted her up to be a double.
His story emerged in bits and bursts, like water from a clogged tap. Often it was hard to understand him. Eventually, though, we gathered that Mary had been made as a servant, one of many, and that these servants had hidden eyes. With her hidden eye, Mary was sending news of us to the profane industries. The bird's eye view, I whispered.
Yeah,
said Jonathan, nodding.
Sure.
That was how they knew she was here.
It's not perfect, Jonathan said. There's a lag, or it cuts out sometimes, or you get things in the wrong order. But basically, yeah.
The back of my neck tingled, as if someone was holding a candle there. She's looking at us right now.
Yep. But like I said, there's a lag. Like 6 weeks. Dr. Stoll thought something got fucked up. Excuse me, wrong. He thought something went wrong with one of her uploads. But me and Judy, we think it was us.
He and Judy had worked on Mary at night, when no one was watching.
Just for fun. We'd get some wine and hang out and code, you know?
One night, as a prank, they had made Mary into what he called a double. She could send her memories to PI and also play them back on her own camera.
So then she was like recording Dr. Stoll, but for herself. We thought it was funny. We were going to collect the captures and show them to him, like for his birthday or something, if we could ever find out when his birthday was. But then she started having these failures, and he got really pissed off about it, and we got scared. We knew if we kept testing her, he was going to find the captures, and then we could lose our internships and be on the street. So we decided to wipe her.
What do you mean? He passed his hand over his brow, as if brushing off sweat.
You know, erase her. Delete. Boom.
I looked at Mim. She was perched on a stack of old pipes, holding her knees very tight. She looked small and concentrated, like paper crumpled into a ball. Jonathan said he had dumped Hard Mary in Jericho one night in a moment of panic, and when he came back for her, she was gone. He only found out where she was when Dr. Stoll discovered her.
You guys finally came through on her feet, and we were like, holy shit. I mean, we were like, wow. You guys are into robots. We got your names, but like, super garbled. I think she read us the entire Bible.
You could hear us?
Pretty good.
Because we... Liddy, Mim said. Be quiet. It was too late. Jonathan's eyes sparkled.
I get it. You found the captures. They're cool, right? I mean, they're pretty low quality, but they're cool. You can get the audio, too. We just didn't get a chance to connect it.
He cracked his long fingers.
If you let me have my backpack, I can do it for you, just to give you a look. Or hey, maybe I can use your stuff.
He gazed at the wall behind Mim, where her tools hung neatly on nails.
Because this is crazy. You're like MacGyver. What is that? A kitchen whisk?
Mim stepped behind him, jerked his arms back, and began to tie the hose.
Aw, man, said Jonathan.
Mim, I said, we have to let him go. She pulled the hose around him and began, clumsily, to wrap it about his legs. He hissed a little when she jostled his injured foot. He'd taken off his shoes and socks. One ankle was thin, the other an ugly bulge.
He needs help, I said. You should have brought Kat, and we have to let him do this, wiping.
Instead of answering me, she told Mary, come on. They went upstairs.
Your friend is super intense, Jonathan said. I respect it, though.
I caught up with Mim and Mary at the corner of the house. The day had grown dim, a mist drifting in from the east. The mists from that direction always have a mournful, acrid mineral smell. They come to us from town. They come from the profane industries. I seized Mim's arm, and she looked at me. At the same moment, Mary stopped and looked at me too. Though she was taller than Mim, with those regular, softly shining features, their movement was the same speed, the same angle. It gave me a jolt to realize it. They looked alike. I even thought that Mary's expression, always so tranquil, seemed stiffer than usual, as if she had taken on some of Mim's fierceness. For Mim's face, though of mortal flesh, was harder than any brass. She glared up at me with her witchy little scowl. I shook off the chilly weakness that had come over me, thinking of Jonathan, who, when I glanced back at him with my foot on the stair, was sitting with his head bowed on his breast, his hair drifting over his brow that had turned a grayish, uneven color. I told her she had to let him go. I said it was a sin. All my rage with her came up and burst like gall. The way she brooded and schemed alone, her secrecy, her mistrust, her sudden blunt demands, her heartlessness, her pride. I told her she'd always been a sneak, ever since we were children. She got a funny look at that, a kind of twitch, Then her face turned narrower and darker, almost purple. And as I paused for breath, she stamped her foot and screamed. She stamped again and screamed something like, "Ark!" Like some savage, blood-mad bird. I stared. I'd never seen her act like this. Even when she was a little girl, when the boys nearly drowned her in the creek, she'd walked home numbly, shivering, but not crying. Now tears shot from her eyes. They didn't come like water dripping, but like a stove exploding. "Leave me alone," she screamed. She jumped up and down. She kicked the earth like a child. "Leave me alone, alone. You don't love me, any of you. You'd pick a foreigner over me." "That's not," I began faintly. "Yes, it is," she said, and started to sob. "Even though he's stronger than me, you don't stick up for me. Nobody sticks up for me, ever, ever. It's just complaints. People coming down with Mary to get her fixed, to get her new heart. And nobody cares when her wheels fall off. Nobody cares if she's rusting. And that Mel Fisher comes around with his friends and wants to watch moving pictures. And old Kurtz wants me to start her building chairs. And now this foreigner comes and she won't obey me. I told her the words, Jephthah's daughter. She wouldn't obey." When she said the words, I flinched, glancing at Mary. "Oh, don't be stupid," wailed Mim. "You have to say her name first. You have to use a special tone. I'm not an idiot, Liddy, and I'm stuck here with fools, and I don't know how to do anything. I've never been taught. And that foreigner, he's got everything. He's got everything, and I'm stuck with kitchen whisks, with a bunch of farmers. And she wouldn't hit him, Liddy. She wouldn't listen to me." She dug her fists into her eyes and cried. "It's good she didn't hit him," I said. "He'd be even worse hurt. He could have wound up dead. Then where would we be?" She shook her head, still sobbing. "It's because she remembers him. She remembers. Don't you see? And he wants to wipe her out so she won't remember anything." "He has to," I said softly. "It's the only way. Otherwise, that PI doctor will keep spying on us. He'll see Jonathan here. He might come after him." "Mim," I interrupted as she tried to speak again. "We got into more than we bargained for. Okay. Now we have to stop." "But she won't know me," she whispered. "She won't know me either," I said. "She'll get to know us again. Come on." I put my arms around her. Mim had never been a hugger. It was like hanging on to a gatepost. I saw her mother watching us through a back window, pressed anxiously to the dirty glass. "Mary's a machine, remember?" I whispered. "That's what you told everyone. Like the thresher." I felt her stiffen even further, hardening like ice. I knew right then she wasn't going to wipe hard Mary's mind. I was right. Over the next few weeks, she would work in the cellar with Jonathan. Sometimes I'd take some apples down there or a basket of rolls and find them arguing with each other, Mim squatting on a crate. Jonathan splay-legged on the floor, his open knapsack and wires and foreign tools around him. And Mim would give me her sideways look, a bit glinting, a bit sly. Now she pulled back and faced me. "Of course I told them that," she said with a splinter of a laugh. How do you think people stay alive? In a gesture that was strange for her, she touched my cheek. Go on home, Liddy. Your pies are burning.